From the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world, from wherever the beautiful game is played, this is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Welcome, everyone, to Beyond the Pitch. And I'm Juan Arango, glad to be with you. It's a pleasure to be able to share different stories with you about different individuals. And I try and shy a little bit from the players, from the coaches, from the pundits. And I want to bring people that are pretty much behind the scenes. But this gentleman, he hasn't been behind the scenes, if you will, because he's been very influential as far as not just soccer, but just sports in general in the United States. And not just sports in general in the United States, but also really being able to help empower the Latino community here in this country. And of course, I'm talking about no one else than other than Hugo Balta over at ESPN. Hugo, how are you, sir? It's a pleasure to finally talk to you. It's been, you know, we've been exchanging messages. We've been talking here and there for a while. Finally being able to exchange actually sounds, voices, you know, amongst ourselves.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Juan, for this invitation. I've been looking forward to it, and great work.
Look, Hugo, one of the things that really has intrigued me, it's not where you are, it's the road that you took to get to where you are right now. Tell, for those of you who aren't familiar, I'd like to be able to go upon on that journey a little bit, Hugo, and how did it start? I mean, how did you get involved in journalism or in media, if you will?
Great. You know, look, I have a similar story to many children of immigrants in the United States. And for me, the path to journalism started with being the el hijo de Hugo y Graciela Balta. You know, I was witness to how my parents, who came to this country at a very early age, how they used media to help them better understand, guide them through their adoptive country of the United States, but also stay connected to their homeland of Peru. And I remember, you know, being 8, 9 years old, 10 years old, going with my mother to do simple chores like going to the bank, and being that bridge, her interpreter with the representative at the bank to open up a checking account, a savings account. Now, I didn't understand what I was translating, but I did understand that it was an important job because I was connecting two people that only understood one language, and two, I was helping my mother meet her goals. So for me, very early on, I understood the power of media and how it could help not only my parents, but people like them, my community. So I was very fortunate to start my career at Telemundo in New York. Being bilingual, bicultural, it was a conscious decision to start my career in Spanish language media. I really felt I could have the most impact in Spanish language media, again, being that bridge, a child of two different cultures and languages. And that path got me to working in the New York City metropolitan area, and then an opportunity with NBC Universal in South Florida. And even though I had grown up in the suburbs of New York City, certainly a very diverse community, mm-hmm. it was the first time where I felt as part of the majority when I lived in Miami-Dade County for 4 years. Mm-hmm. If you've spent any time in South Florida, you know we not only serving the food at the restaurant, we're cooking the food, we own the restaurant where we're patronizing. So it was the first time where I felt like, wow, you know, we are larger than ourselves as individuals, and really also helped me continue to embrace my bilingualism. I mean, tú no puedes caminar en Miami-Dade County si es que no sabes hablar el español. So that was very powerful to me. yeah. South Florida, you know, being the gateway to Latin America, that it's very important to be bilingual and certainly bicultural. So almost the first 20 years of journalism was mm-hmm. in straight news, both local network and cable. And it was in 2011 that I was recruited by a third party to consider an opportunity at ESPN. Now, I to be honest with you, ESPN was never in my path, my flight plan. But when the opportunity presented itself, and I learned more about the opportunities to be able to be a storyteller, a journalist in a company that certainly was at the forefront of embracing technology to enhance the experience of viewers, a company that is in English and Spanish, with ESPN Deportes, ESPN, multiple platform with a very robust international footprint. I jumped at the chance, and I've never looked back.
Yeah, I mean, it usually isn't when you're being looked at by ESPN. It's never in your flight plan, really. But it's like if it were a comparison to a flight plan, it's like you fly into New York, and all of a sudden the pilot says, "You know, you're a good guy. Why don't I take you to Hawaii?" You know, it's just one of those types of things. And I understand exactly where you're coming from, because I used to be at ESPN at one moment, actually when Deportes just was getting started. I remember the recruiting trips that they took here to Miami, and they, one of the advert, or I don't know if it was good advertising or bad advertising, but that said, "Hey, you know what? It's 80 degrees here. It's 10 degrees in Bristol." And I'm like, "I don't care. I want to be there." And there were many people that did make that jump at it, and many are still there. And I can completely get what you're saying, but I wanted to go a little bit further back, because it was interesting. You mentioned too the fact that you were the official translator of the family, and many of us Latin, myself included, I was, until my sister came along and I was, you know, doing my stuff in high school, she was the official translator. Tell me a little bit about there's a great deal of pressure on Latino kids, even back then, even now, to be with that type of burden, because you're like, "Man, what if I screw up? What if I do this? What if I do that wrong?" That's also a great burden to deal with as a kid.
Yeah, you know, look, all props to my parents, right?
Yeah.
I have friends and even family members that are my generation that are not bilingual. You know, I think Latinos, like other immigrant groups before them, you know, they suffer through a lot of prejudice that they don't want their children to have to go through. And so they push them to speak English, they give them a quote unquote American name, and really push them to assimilate to the American culture. My parents were different in that. They very early on made it a point that I understood that I had deep roots in Peru. I remember my first years in schooling was 9 months out of the year. I was in the United States studying here, and I would spend summers in Peru and study there also, and learning where I came from. So I very much felt that I wasn't just, I am definitely the 200% that Univision has coined. I'm 100% American and very proud of being part of that experience. And I'm 100% Peruvian and I'm very proud of my, de mis raíces. Yes. And so in speaking Spanish, right? Because I think it happens now, right?
Yeah.
Spanish, regardless of a person's proficiency, it is still a way that we self-identify as a group, as a Latino, as a Hispanic. And it's not so much that I felt that I need to speak perfect Spanish. I need to read it well, speak it well, write it well. Certainly my parents and even my wife that is a native Colombian always corrects me. But the important part is that it was integrated in part of how I showed up and how I interacted with others and how we communicated. Those bridges, sometimes they're not as solid as we want them to be, but they're still bridges connecting people together and sometimes people separated by not only by language, by culture, but also ideology. So yes, absolutely. A little bit, you know, apprehensive at first, but when people understand that what you're trying to do is help in communication, they make a lot of allowances. And so it's very, for me now as a 48-year-old, when I meet young people or people in my generation that kind of feel badly that they don't speak Spanish or they speak broken Spanish, I tell them, you are no less Latino than I am because I speak more Spanish than you do, or I can read much better than you can, etc. What we need to be focused on isn't so much language proficiency than it is cultural proficiency. That is the key in order for us to be successful in whatever job that we're in whatever industry we're a part of.
Yeah, and Hugo, let me ask you this, because it's always been something that I've been curious about, and I agree with what you're saying there. Was there, when you saw these issues going on, and you were at, I don't know, where when that moment occurred, when that light bulb pretty much lighted up, what was it, you know, that aha moment, you're like, hey, you know, I'm in journalism, but my calling's a little bit higher. I think that we can do something with this for Latinos, and not just for Latinos, because maybe about 10, 15 years ago, you did see this trend of second and third generation Latinos here in the United States being able to speak in English, consume their content in English, and things of that. Did you see that trend? When did that light bulb go off with you specifically? And you saying, hey, you know what? This is what we have to strive for. And ultimately, of course, coming and ending with the final product, or at least somewhat of a final product of what you have right now at ESPN.
My father instilled in me early on the importance of working with the community and giving back to the community. I remember being very young and accompanying my father to the airport to pick up sometimes strangers coming from Peru, and he would help them find a temporary place to stay, help them find a job. And that, you know, to me was also very powerful. I remember, again, my father being very involved with the Peruvian community in Paterson, New Jersey, where I was born and grew up, and always talking about the importance of people working together, you know, to be a force within the United States, but also to retain their culture and their language. Now, for me, journalism assisted me in realizing what my father raised me to be. You know, journalism is the only industry in the United States that is protected by the Constitution. It is the right of journalists to hold the powerful accountable, to give voice to the voiceless, and empower the community by giving them information to make better decisions. Now, as a journalist, I often was and am the only one in the room, the only Latino in an editorial meeting, sometimes the only Latino in a newsroom, sometimes the only person of color in the newsroom. And when you look at statistically across the country, regardless of the platform, including in markets where Latinos are not the majority, but the emerging majority, if not the majority in that market, markets like New York City, like Miami, like Los Angeles, we're underrepresented in newsrooms. Overwhelmingly, newsrooms are middle-aged white males. And so that tells me a couple of things. And often we see some of these hiccups that happen in storytelling that are patronizing, sometimes stereotypical. We're not telling our stories. Others are telling our stories. With the current administration, the Trump administration, immigrants are under fire. But if you look at who are writing those stories, if you look at who are reporting those stories, again, whether it's print, whether it's radio, whether it's television, digital, overwhelmingly, they're not Latinos. And there's a difference, and not note this to journalists, because I know there's a lot of great journalists that can tell a very good story, but there's a difference between telling a story from the point of view of an outsider looking in and telling the same story because you're part of that community and you understand that experience, whether you lived it yourself or you bore witness to it.
Yeah, I mean, and what you say is true. I mean, the percentage of people in newsrooms of Latino descent, I mean, it's not just a minority. I mean, it's like microscopic, like 6%, 6.1%, based on a study that was done back in 2015, 2016. Like 6% of newsrooms are you know, consist of Latino journalists, and I think that's something that really has been in some cases a hindrance to the growth or the development of those types of stories, because we see a lot of top athletes, we see a lot of great sports stories, and that's something that you've been able to do as far as ESPN, and which leads me to my next question. When you were at ESPN, or when you were working your way up at ESPN, where you were at, how did, when this idea comes up to start bringing in Spanish language content for English speaking Latinos, what kind of response initially was given? Was there a lot of positive? Was there like a lot of pitching that you had to do? And at the same time, was there any brushback saying, oh, come on, you know, no, that's not the way things go. We need to, you know, if they want to see the stories, have them go to Deportes or something like that. What did you get, both positive and negative?
Well, I'm very fortunate to work in a company that understands the importance of remaining relevant to your audience. You know, ESPN, it mirrors very much the sports, the teams that they cover. This is a very competitive company. This is a company that strives to be on the starting lineup. No one wants to sit on the bench. So everybody strives to show up in their A game. And like any athlete, you need to continue to hone your skills. You need to, whether you're in season or off season, you need to continuously better yourself if you want to remain competitive at that elite level. Applying it to U.S. Hispanics, you know, ESPN understands that in order to continue to grow and remain in its position as the worldwide leader in sports, it is imperative for the company to do to continuously question the status quo and look to evolve and change its culture in order to be able to not only recruit top talent, but also be inclusive in the development of content from conception to execution to completion in all different facets. So there are situations where, you know, we're talking about what is the best way to tell a story, you know, first talking about language, where we say, well, instead of dubbing over an interview in Spanish, in English, let's listen to their own voices and subtitle it.
Yeah,
and now,
of course.
Look, you know, we look at social media and we see some of the most popular videos are subtitled, regardless of whether they're in English or a different language. So it does help that technology has afforded us an audience that is used to reading subtitles as part of how they consume their news and information and entertainment. But I've worked on projects where we have simulcast a bilingual program and seamlessly go from English to Spanish in that program that's running on ESPN Deportes and ESPN Network in English, and no one's batted an eye. And this is in prime time. And I've been fortunate to work for other media companies that would never consider a Spanish language or even a bilingual program in their prime time for fear of alienating their base. This is a company that is not that understands. You know, you have to take risks if you want to continue to lead. And I'm not saying be careless. I mean, these are educated risks, but it's not heavy lifting to bring up ideas at all different facets and different levels that sometimes seems to be going against the grain. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't situations where, you know, it's heavy lifting. And certainly I'm not saying that there isn't room for growth in that space at ESPN, but someone that's, you know, circling a 25-year career and have been around the block a couple of times, some of it driven by the genre of sports, ESPN is certainly at the forefront of embracing diversity and inclusion. And when it comes to reaching U.S. Hispanics, understanding the nuances, both in language and in culture, in reaching them.
Hugo, and I'm here with Hugo Balta over, Vice President of Latino Content over at ESPN. And Hugo, it's interesting you mention all this because you talk about bases, and Latinos have bases to a certain extent as well. And you mentioned it in some articles that you've written. Even those I had asked on Twitter the other day about, you know, people that had questions to send you. There was one and you came out and you answered and you kind of beat me to the punch. I wasn't expecting you to answer it on Twitter, but it's all good. It's still all good and fine. But about the bases, because when you talk about that, here in the United States, the first minority or the first Latino group that is usually, or actually sometimes the only Latino group that's catered to, is the Mexicans. And it's not a negative. I mean, obviously they're what, almost 50%+ of the Latino population in the United States, but you end up losing a lot of the other bases. When you start seeing a commercial for the World Cup and everyone's wearing a Mexican national team jersey, it's not that you've been forgotten. It's just, hey, they're not even talking to me. So why should I consume that product, or why should I watch that broadcast? Tell me a little bit about that as far as what has been changing in that perspective or what needs to be changed.
Well, look, you know, I think there's no turnkey strategy in reaching U.S. Hispanics. I remember being part of meetings where when you talked about reaching U.S. Hispanics, it was Spanish only. A lot of that obviously is driven by a lack of diversity, and not just diversity in regards of race, or ethnicity, but diversity of thought, of experience. And so I've been in enough meetings that when you talk about U.S. Hispanics, it's almost synonymous with Mexican and Mexican Americans. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that. As you said, Mexican Americans are the majority within U.S. Hispanics. But I quickly mention that in order to be successful, it is important to understand that a Latino in the West Coast is very different than a Latino in the East Coast. And it's not just about country of origin. It's also about just anybody that lives in the East Coast has a different experience than someone that lives in the West Coast. So, and everybody in between. I've been fortunate enough to work in different markets, including the Midwest, in different places in Texas, certainly Chicago, Arizona, I mentioned South Florida. And so it's important to, one, understand that if you're going to design marketing strategies to reach U.S. Hispanics, success is based on our ability to be hyper-focused. Don't think that what is relevant to a Mexican and Mexican American is going to be the same to a Puerto Rican that is certainly part historically also part of the United States than it is to a Colombian than it is to a Central American from El Salvador, etc. So it's very important to design messages and pivot depending on what market geographically you're focused on, as well as the community you're trying to reach. Now, where I think in future generations there's a great opportunity is in understanding, as much as I am, I'm a second generation Peruvian American, as much as I am proud of being of my Peruvian roots, I am also equally proud of being part of a larger family that's called Latinos and or Hispanics. And that is very powerful because as future generations, second, third, fourth generations, I continue to reacculturate, right? Because it is a necessity, like I said, to be culturally proficient in the United States if you want to be successful in business. It is also important to understand to be able to embrace what we have in common more so than what makes us different. So while I am not a Mexican-American or a Colombian or Puerto Rican or Dominican, I appreciate that we do have similarities in language and history. And in the United States, regardless of how we self-identify, generally speaking, we are seen as part of a whole. And that is where we truly have our power, socially, politically, economically. In order for our community to follow in the footsteps of, say, the African-American community and other communities like them, we need to let go of some of that baggage that our parents bring with them that's very nationalistic about the country that they come from and start to embrace who we are in this country, Latinos and Hispanics, if we're going to get to the next level.
Yeah, from a lot of friends back, when I was in school here in Miami, here the eso en Cuba no pasa, that kind of rhetoric that goes on. I mean, of course, very obvious. Let me switch that a little bit more to what you're saying in the football setting, in the soccer setting, because, and I've had Hercules Gomez on here before. I've had a couple of other talents from ESPN on here before, and I've talked to them. I said, look, what's going on there is very even to Max a couple of weeks ago, I was congratulating him on the LAFC job because it really means something to have a Latino voice, and Max is surely one of those. But what ESPN's been able to do is to get that Latino voice out there. It's not like just content and have, whoever, present, a story about, Hispanic baseball player, basketball player, soccer player, whatever. But you also have that Latino voice, that Latino talent to be able to give it a different spin or a different little bit of spice that gives it even more significance to it. How do you see that aspect, especially in a sport is followed or is passionate by us, by la raza, if you will, to use that term, like football? How do you see that coverage? And now that you start to see a little bit more, although still lacking in numbers, but you still start to see more numbers as far as Latinos being involved in a sport like soccer, in English specifically.
Well, look, I think we need to do a better job. And I'm not just talking about ESPN, but in general, English language media needs to do a better job of integrating more Latino talent, as you pointed out, Max, Hercules, and others, in the coverage of the sport, in the calling of the games. I grew up watching football con mi viejo, no, with my father, with my grandfather, in Spanish. And that's how I consume that sport. Unless there's no other way to watch a soccer game in Spanish, I'll watch it in English. But there's a different nuance. There's more excitement in watching a game in Spanish and hearing the play by play and the announcers call the game. That same enthusiasm, excitement needs to be integrated into how the game is being called and covered in English language. I think a lot of what I see in regards to the coverage of the sport is very European, right? I think that's understandable. The more high quality, premier quality soccer is being played in Europe, and certainly there's certainly a strategy to recruit voices from Premier League and others, Bundesliga, etc. But when you look at the United States and you look at fandom specifically to that sport, overwhelmingly, the opportunity is with the Latino community, and I'd even say take a look at Liga MX, right? I mean, Liga MX rivals some of the more established leagues in the United States as far as fandom.
Yeah.
There's a great opportunity in integrating Liga MX as part of the regular diet and covering that sport. Look at, what MLS has been doing in its almost 25-year history, continuing to expand the teams, continuing to recruit talent, including in Mexico and certainly south of the border, making it more relevant to its fan base, looking to improve the quality of the players, kind of continuing to get away from this persona of a retirement league and really emerging as a league of choice for young talent and developing that talent both domestically and abroad. So there's definitely steps being taken in the right direction, both about the sport in this country, the coverage of the sport in this country, but there's still more room for growth, and it is imperative to continue to integrate different voices, primarily Latino voices, into the how you're packaging and serving up that sport.
Switch this for you, and I know, and I want to thank you for being on here. Where were you the last time? The last time that Peru was in a World Cup?
I was 12 years old, living in Patterson, and I remember Peru scoring that first goal. Man, it's been a long, long time, and even just to get to Russia, right? I mean, there's something about poetic about uh-huh. being the last team to make it into the World Cup. So look, I'm ecstatic. We're so happy. Even at last week's 2-0 victory against Croatia, really good showing. I'm really looking forward to tonight's game against Iceland. We're in a kind of tough group C. France is the expected winner of that group, but I think I think we got a really good shot. Denmark definitely has a good squad. I think Australia's still struggling with its managers, but I think we've got a really, I think, as a Cinderella team, I think we've got a good chance of coming out of that group.
I mean, because it was interesting to hear Robert Bides the other day say the toughest match that France is going to have is Peru, and I mean, I've followed Peru throughout the latter stages of the, I was doing match commentary during the Copa America Centenario, and I happened to be at that 1-0 win against Brazil. Actually, I was doing commentary for it, and the Peruvian fans at Gillette were just going nuts. So obviously my
story, and I was there. I was there.
You're going to be at Patterson.
That was not a handball. There's the la mano de Dios for
Maradona.
Diego. I'll tell you, eso fue la mano de San Martín de Porres. If anybody touched that ball, it was San Martín de Porres.
Yeah, of course. I saw it from the I saw something hit that ball from where I was, and that the scouting booths up in like the 300s right next to the lights, and I could actually see ESPN studios from Gillette Stadium. I saw that goal going. That's where my story took off. And of course it ends, or at least it continues, into the World Cup qualifying playoff against New Zealand. And then seeing the crowd on Friday, Hugo, it was just absolutely amazing. And you felt it because, I mean, even the journalists in the press box were singing the anthem, and there was this pride, there was this joy, I mean, there's really nothing that really can describe it, but there was just, different type of posture that they went when the anthem went, and you hear all the Peruvian journalists stand up and do this while the entire stadium is singing in unison. I mean, it was really, and I'm a neutral, but Colombia, I went through the same thing with Colombia 4 years ago, but obviously not as long as you guys, but still to see that whole emotion that's gone through. And that's, I think, one of the things that can be transmitted a little bit more with the media. I mean, there's certain entities that haven't been able to embrace that fervor, that passion that comes across with Latino teams like Peru, like Colombia, like Brazil, Argentina, Mexico, that they say, oh yeah, you know, they're crazy fans, but they don't understand the true passion that consists of what football is all about to them.
And that's where there's room for improvement, right? I work for a network that prides itself in the sophistication of how sports content is presented, right? When you turn on SportsCenter, you're gonna spend, you know, 10 minutes or an hour on watching SportsCenter, and you're gonna leave with some knowledge, right? You're gonna leave with, you know, information that you could share with your family, your friends, yeah, around the dinner table, whatever, having a beer. The same, and primarily around, you know, major sports in the United States, right? NFL, college football, NBA, MLB, the same type of sophistication needs to be applied to the sport. So when we're talking about the World Cup, absolutely, look, very disappointing that the United States didn't make it to the World Cup, but Mexico made it to the World Cup. And in this country, with the amount of Mexican Americans, that's like having the second home team make it to the World Cup. But that's not good enough, because you have to also understand that there's nearly 400,000 Peruvians in the United States. And I'm not even including the folks that live up in Toronto or in Puerto Rico. And you need to understand that's a Cinderella team. That's an important team to watch and to cover. And what about Panama? I mean, you talk about Cinderella. That's a great story also. You need to cover that story. And I haven't even gotten to Argentina. Colombia, Argentina with Messi, the number one player in the world, arguably. Colombia with James. I haven't even started to talk about the other teams from Latin America that they need to take that we as sports journalists need to pay attention and provide content, not as a outsider looking in. Look at this tournament that we didn't make it, but actually from a position of, hey, we know that a great portion of Americans and residents and people who just live in the United States are watching this event, and they're looking for information and content about Mexico, Peru, Panama, Colombia, and everybody and every other team in Latin America. Yeah. That's very important, and that's an opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, people were shocked in Copa America in the opener when they said, yeah, the stadium's almost sold out. But then when they realized that, you know, about three quarters of the stadium was, you know, wearing yellow jerseys, and they're like, wait, what happened to the American fans? Oh, no, these are Colombian fans. And people are like, hey, wait a second, where'd they come from? And they don't realize that Colombia's, you know, Colombians are amongst the, you know, four top, you know, the top four as far as population of Latinos in the United States.
Yeah.
You know, after Mexico, Puerto Rico, and I think it's I'm going blank on the third one. I think Cubans or Dominicans. I think it's somewhere around there. But I guess you catch my drift as far as that's concerned. But
yeah, you know, it's important. It's important to, again, it goes back to cultural proficiency. You know, Latinos are not the others. We are very much part of the American community and experience. So that's where a lack of diversity comes into play. And again, it's not just about race and gender. It's also about thought and experience. The difference between us and we is who tells the story. And too often, these types of stories are being told by someone that does not understand. This country is very much a Latin country. There are more Latinos in the United States of the more than 25 countries where Latinos reside, self-described Latinos, and Spanish is spoken. This is the second only to Mexico. So in order to understand that, is very important if you, again, from a business standpoint, right? Because diversity and inclusion isn't just a moral right thing to do, but it's the right business thing to do. If you want to be successful, whether it's in media or in any other industry, you need to be culturally proficient.
Hugo, I wish I had all afternoon and then some to be able to talk to you some more about this issue, but I know you got to run. I know you got other things to do, and you're probably going to the game, so I'm not gonna try and arrest you anymore. Look, it's a pleasure. I hope you're down here in May when there's this the big sports conference that's going on down here with you know everybody from MLS and Borussia Dortmund and you know a bunch of others. I wish you were down here. Well, you'll probably be down here for Hispanicize, correct?
Yeah, I'm there next month. I'll be there in a couple of weeks for Hispanicize, and yeah. I'll certainly try to. You don't need to twist my arm to go to South Florida, especially in April. The weather's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, I thought we're gonna have to drag you out of that weather up in the Northeast. I mean, you know, who'd want to come down here when you have, you know, all the great weather that's going on up there?
What do you mean? You don't vacation in Central Connecticut? I mean, I used to.
I used to spend my falls over in New London and heading over to Southington to the apple orchards, man. So I mean, I'm all about Connecticut and Rhode Island and going up to Massachusetts. So I'm good. I spent a couple of times in Maine. So. Anyways,
really, like, I mean, you know it, right? It's a beautiful part of the country, New England, especially in the fall, in the spring. Beautiful, beautiful. But there's something about South Florida. I mean, I lived there for 4 years. I never could get used to the humidity. You know, I grew up in the Northeast, so I, you know, to see palm trees and in, you know, December and decorated for Christmas, it was a little bit odd.
Yeah.
Pero tengo muchos amigos de Miami, de South Florida. Mm-hmm. It's a second home. Hopefully I'll get to see you when I'm down there in a couple of weeks.
I hope so. I really do. And we'll keep discussing a little bit more. I mean, look, to be honest with you, in all defense to you, there's two things that people never get accustomed to down here: humidity and hurricanes. So hurricanes are always the great equalizer when you're talking to people that live in the cold. That's usually always the great equalizer for them. But anyway, Hugo, again, thank you so much for being on the show. Look forward to seeing where can people exchange, because you're an individual that's very open and really is extremely engageable on social media. Where can people contact you, ask you questions, all types of inquiries?
Hey, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at Hugo Balta. I have a Facebook page, Straight Talk in Media. You could, where I certainly share the work of other great journalists and storytellers that are bringing to light issues and opportunities around this space. And certainly in LinkedIn as well, at Hugo Balta. Happy to engage with people, happy to help them along their journey, as so many other selfless people have done with me and continue to do with me. So it's very important for all of us to be supportive of one another and certainly look to help others further their careers and their interests, always looking to collaborate. So please look me up.
Will do, sir. Have a good one. And it's been a pleasure to have you, Hugo Balta. Thank you so much for being with us on Beyond the Pitch.